Welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. We celebrated 10 years with our most recent episode, and we are back and hoping for another 10 years. Who knows how long? As always, I'm your host, Neil Horowitz. You can find me on Twitter, NJH287. Also on LinkedIn, where I post more content. The website is still, and always will be, dsmsports.net. And of course, follow along, subscribe on your preferred podcast platform. Super cool show for you guys today. Really enjoy this guest. Just a lot of interesting stuff around, you know, what the future of journalism looks like, what the future of being a journalist and a reporter looks like in this world where we hear of, you know, layoffs all the time, it seems like, with The Athletic, with New York Times, with ESPN. How can a journalist make their way these days? And my guest in the podcast today is David Alter. You're going to hear about his journey, what he's doing today. He is a reporter with Sports Illustrated, but as you'll hear, he has a lot of things going on that he has cooking, including a new newsletter launching next month in October, depending on when you're listening to this. He talks about his ups and downs, you know, throughout his career, where he's had to, you know, struggle for work at times and almost quit the business, but now is pretty much thriving as a reporter, working on the Toronto Maple Leafs beat. So if you are a hockey fan, or especially a Maple Leafs fan, you no doubt will have seen some of David Alter's work. But just really interesting stuff about where he is, where his content goes, the strategy that he puts into play, how he makes revenue beyond, you know, what he gets from writing with SI and the hockey news. Just really interesting stuff that whether you work in and around sports media, sports and social, you will learn a lot and get some cool insight from David. So listen up. Here's my conversation with David Alter. Right back with today's guest, and I'm so psyched to be talking to him. We could have been recording the last like half hour, just been so inspired and learning so much from him. My guest on the show today is David Alter. He is a reporter for the Toronto Maple Leafs, writes for Sports Illustrated, but also just does a ton of other work, as he'll let us know. David, welcome to the podcast today.
And Neil, my pleasure. You know, we connected a couple of years ago, and so I'm really excited to be on and share everything, because I'm a big fan of yours as well. And I'm really excited to be on.
I'm just so cool. You are like seriously charting a new path for what it means to be a journalist, to be a writer, to be a contributor, to cover sports. But tell us about your path, like how you got to where you are today, your stops along the way, the challenges, the opportunities, and just any tips for folks that want to try to do what you do.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, I'm 41 years old. When I first got into this business, whether it was broadcast or written or any sports content, you know, I was 24, 23 years old, an intern at the All Sports radio station in Toronto. And the model then was you interned, then you got hired. And then as that company went along and I got hired, that turned into an 8-year employment at Sportsnet. And everything was good. You know, my career was building up. I became the Leafs reporter for the radio station for the final 3 years of Sportsnet radio there. And, you know, the way things change and mediums change and priorities change and what we see with legacy media, in my final year, my employment there ended. And then along the way, you know, I wrote for the Leafs website for one season. Then I joined the National Post as a Leafs writer, but also as just a staff sports writer in the fall of 2015. That job ended abruptly when they cut the whole sports department in early of 2016. That was 2 weeks after my probationary period ended, where you think you're the most safe. From that turned into an employment at Twitter for about 8 months. Before I landed at The Athletic, I was actually one of the very first Toronto hires when they were only in the Chicago and Toronto markets in 2016. But then after that, you know, startup culture was what it was. They didn't know what they were, and it wasn't really the best fit. That after that, for a few years, it was a struggle. Like, I didn't work for a year as I tried to find a job in my mid-30s that was better suited to my qualifications. And for a year, I think I went through like 6 different hardcore interviews where you make multiple rounds. Yeah. And then you're like, and then I was always the last round of interviews before they went with someone else. And those, and they were not necessarily in Toronto. I was ready to move. Like, I was ready to go to different markets. I really wanted to be a reporter and do it for whatever situation arose. And for whatever reason, I just couldn't. And so a close friend of mine who works for another legacy operation in Canada, after I told him about the most recent one and how dejected I was, he's like, well, they have this web writing thing. It might, I know it's not what you want, but like it's available. And I can, and at that point I just kind of rolled a roller and I was like, yeah, sure. And he's like, really? He's like, yeah. I mean, I was for a year, I was doing nothing. Couldn't really figure out. I'm like, I may as well go out and have a purpose to get out of the house and go to an office and do that and just maybe get a new experience at a place I've never worked before and see what would happen. But what ended up being 2 years of freelance work there, not really doing anything to advance my career. It was actually the first time I just left the job outright by myself after going through that stuff. And from there, an opportunity with the Hockey News came in the beginning of 2021 that I was ready to jump in on full stop. Very different model. That turned into something with Sports Illustrated because Sports Illustrated has a partnership with the Hockey News, and now it's a model that I think we're going to see a lot of, which is you have your own microsite and you do it as a business. And so that's grown now to the point where I'm able to operate somewhat independently. Like, I mean, I still have to obviously adhere to guidelines and be professional and do all that stuff. But I mean, who wouldn't? But it allows you to operate independently that you can sell yourself and not necessarily feel locked in to one particular situation. And if you are entrepreneurial enough, and you build a background enough and you learn things along the way, I think it's actually one of the better situations, whether you feel like you can not merge to being an influencer, but if you can take the elements of marketing and influencing into part of your job, I think it really can be super beneficial for you.
Totally. We're going to pick apart all this and go into what you've been able to do to truly just almost reinvent the paradigm as you go and build this thing as you go. It's really, really cool. But I want to take a quick step back to like how you ultimately decided on this career path and also too, to sort of like look at what the difference is between being a broadcaster, between being a reporter, between being a writer and a columnist. Like, yeah, you can write long feature stories or you can, develop relationships and try to break news. Or you can go with the broadcast side and work on your record games and record your play calls. So like what when did you kind of make that decision on the direction you wanted to go and what did that mean for the skill set you needed and the relationships you need to start collecting?
Yeah, so I got really lucky in my university or college days, if you will. So I went to Western University, formerly University of Western Ontario, which is in London, Ontario. I had an idea of what I wanted to do, but I wasn't sure. So I was always really good at math in high school, and I thought I wanted to be an actuary, which is statistical mathematics. And so I was doing like hardcore math in my first couple of years. But what happened was, not necessarily knowing if I want to do math or I want to do business, I decided, for whatever reason, I was in res again for the second year. I just couldn't find a good off-campus situation that I liked. I liked res where like your meals are taken care of and you don't have to worry about a lot of the other things that come with living in residence. That I lived in res the second year, and they put me on a media faculty floor because of a numbers imbalance. It had nothing to, usually they try to, like, if it's a media faculty floor by design, they try to put someone upper year who's also in there, but it just didn't work out that way. And so because I was there and they were short on frosh leaders, which are like the people who help the frosh during orientation week and stuff, they're like, well, like, can you work with them? I'm like, yeah, sure. It's a media faculty floor. But my best friend also worked in media, or like was doing this kind of major. And like, I remember when, like, at a different university, when I came to visit him, he was doing a campus radio station show, and I just came on just to fill the time because he was doing the graveyard shift before they filled stuff. And so I'm like, okay, whatever. I mean, I don't know if it's for me because, it's a lot of independent music. I don't really have that interest. I really didn't want to go to this info session. You know, the second week of school, they have all those, like, in the big building, they have like all these clubs that you can
Yeah, like
join
the
and
bar,
stuff.
yeah.
Yeah. And so I'm like, oh, I don't know. Okay, sure. But because I was on media faculty floor, they kind of pushed me to go with them. I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. So I'm just sitting there and I'm like, not really paying much of attention to it for the campus radio station. And they're like, yeah, here's this guy, Carlo, who's in charge of the news and sports department. I'm like, come again? He's like, yeah, we do play-by-play for varsity sports. I'm like, that sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
To the point where, like, I just leaned into that and I enjoyed it so much that I spent more time doing that than I was ever in class or doing homework, to my maybe to my detriment, but I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. And then, like, I just loved calling play-by-play. It's kind of what I always wanted to do. It also was a way for me to stay engaged in the game because you remember everything you say, or at least that's kind of my recall. So, I did that. I called some hockey, some basketball, some football. And then between years 3 and 4, the news and sports director, that guy who like was in charge of that department, died suddenly at age 38. And he had type 1 diabetes and he lived alone and he had a complication. And I remember we'd just done a broadcast with him where I was a sideline reporter. He was a play-by-play guy for the football team. And we went to his memorial. And then I don't know what it was, but like I just felt more like I have to give this a try. Like I have to give this career a try. So that ended up being after school, I just kind of dropped down to economics because the math started getting way too hard for me and I had no ambition to finish that I kind of dropped down to economics just to kind of get it out of the way as fast as possible. And then I submitted my demo of the stuff I was doing at college to a guy who was a sports director at the All Sports radio station in Toronto. I got his email address from some contact that I knew, and he got back to me pretty quickly. And he's like, I don't have, you know, when you're trying to reach out to people, you don't know what to say. I think I put like full-time, part-time slash internship. Like, I didn't know what to say.
Right.
And I just sent him some MP3 clips. He's like, I don't have any positions, and I'm completely stacked with interns, but call me. I'm willing to hear you out. So my heart's beating a mile a minute. I have no idea what to say to this guy or what it means. So he invites, after we spoke, he invites me to a meeting at his place and at his office. And he's like, I wasn't lying when I said that, like that I don't have space, but I will have an intern spot open in a few months. Reach out to me in a couple months, and then we'll see what we can do about getting you in there. And so then those 3 months came about making sure he remembered me. He didn't remember me. I remember I found out that the radio station was like on because sometimes he doesn't respond to emails. I learned later as I worked for him that like I remember listening to the radio station that like he was doing like an on location at as a host. He sometimes hosted at the
Yeah.
mall. I'm like, okay, perfect. I'm gonna go on location and reintroduce myself so that he remembers me, and that proves to be beneficial. Anyway. That internship turned into doing some on-air stuff. And you have to recall, like, the sports radio station that I worked at was like the fourth one ever in North America. Like, it was such a pioneering format. I wasn't allowed a TV in my room. When the Jays were winning the World Series in the late 90s or early 90s, I was listening to that station on my Walkman. And like, I grew up with all those people. So, working at that radio station was a dream come true. And so, yeah, that turned into an internship, which turned into part-time regular staff to eventually becoming Leaf reporter. But like for a lot of my mid to late 20s, I worked there and I never said no to anything. And I just worked my butt off. I lived close to the station that if there was a last minute illness or someone had to do a sports casting shift or whatever, or a reporting assignment came up, it was just immediately me. And I used technology to my advantage too, because back in 2006 when that started, you know, a lot of people didn't have smartphones back then, but I had learned how to get my work email, which they gave to interns, onto my BlackBerry. And whenever he would send out opportunities, to interns, hey, who could do this? I was usually one of the first to respond. I can do it. I can do it. And so that's essentially that turned into that. That's how I found the love for the business. And despite some of the pitfalls that come along the way, the love outweighed the feeling of ever wanting to do anything else for my career.
Was there a point there where like you went from I still enjoy broadcasting news and telling the news, but I'm gonna shift now to actually breaking the reporting the news and chasing these storylines and going to the pressers. So like going what was there a clear shift for you and that affected like what you did?
I think it was mostly when I was doing stuff on air at the station, it was more reporting than anything else. Because back then, the Fan 590, which later got rebranded under Sportsnet, but when it was its own brand, it held a pride of making sure no matter how important the event, that someone from the fan was there. Whether it was an intern, a staffer, or whatever, they made sure someone was there so that they show that the fan was everywhere. Like that was the whole thing. And so a lot of my stuff always came with reporting in mind. When I would do sportscasting or I would do hosting, it wasn't the same kind of, for me, play by play was number one, but play by play didn't really, there wasn't openings for that there. What I did do was I did, like with the campus radio station, I did free myself up on Saturdays to still call football games, which my boss at the fan encouraged because he didn't have a backups for these people. So it was nice for him to know I was still getting that experience somewhere else in the event they had to throw someone to do play-by-play football for the Argos, for example, right? Like there's just like that kind of stuff that can happen. And so for me, reporting has kind of always been the thing. And then it really just changed from, am I doing 40-second scripts to am I going to do other things? I did a podcast back in 2007 with some colleagues at the fan when podcasts weren't really a thing and no one was really doing them, but Apple had launched this concept, and that's why they're called podcasts, because Apple really created it on iPods. And we would do these things. I had a funny pun name called The Altercation, but like it had no, like there was nothing to it. We were just shooting the shit about nothing. Now when I look back on it, I wish we would have continued it, but it's amazing how that stuff is kind of commoditized now. And I always just kind of saw reporting as part of it, and storytelling really number one. And like I think that's what links everything. And so as you evolve, it's like, okay, there's broadcasting, sure, but everything's kind of being redefined. You really have to know how to just tell what you need to tell on multiple platforms, because video is changing, audio is changing, written is changing, social media has changed everything. And so you really just have to adapt and find different ways to tell the story.
Let's talk about when social media started to become a bigger and bigger part of your job and how you continue to use it over the years to not just support the work you're doing, but to really also, frankly, build your own brand, build your own community, and become someone that fans come to know and come to love.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know about the love part, but I do appreciate that. The 2009 was when I opened the Twitter account. That's where I kind of saw a little bit of the value in it, where it was like you can say what's happened, you can use the internet as a platform to kind of tell more than what you got to tell. As exciting as it was growing up on that radio station, when I'd be doing these hits, I'd have what, 30 to 40 seconds of airtime an hour? And then at that point, like, where's it living? There wasn't really anywhere for it to go. And so, you start using the internet first, because if I had longer interviews, I wanted people to hear longer versions of that interview. So I would put those up on the Fan 590 website, which is no longer in existence, but you could still find on the Wayback Machine. There's that. There's also social media was just a way of like really kind of making me aware that radio was kind of in trouble. Because back in the day, before 2009, if you wanted to go to any medium for real-time information, you went to radio. Like the radio station did updates every 20 minutes for that reason. Because they knew if you wanted to hear the latest, you would get it within 20 minutes or less, as opposed to TV stations didn't necessarily break in for live events in sports to disrupt their sports programming on medium range news or whatever, like the whatever the needle was, whatever was sold for inventory in that programming is what it was. But then once Twitter came around, I saw, was it the plane that went down in Jamaica Bay, where Twitter was the first to kind of break that story before news outlets? And I was like, okay, you know what? This could actually start changing everything. And I kind of saw Twitter as kind of the new radio, because I would always break these things by just going up on the next update and calling in and being like, hey, we're at Leaf practice. This person has showed up. It means he's been called up because I know because the rules are so-and-so, whatever. We can kind of explain that, where it's like, okay, well, now instead of doing that, I can put that on Twitter the moment I see that. And then I can go into further context on the radio station, but there is also that. And then in 2010, 2011 comes around, you know, the time frame to do those sports hits are getting shorter and shorter. And you're kind of wondering, okay, what's kind of the future of this? And so that's kind of where I started leaning hard into social media, because you started to see the power in that and kind of changing things in that regard in terms of consumption. And now you're seeing it over a decade and decades that the way people kind of consume their content, it's not like how we used to, where we just flip on the tube or put something on. Like, I probably spend more time on YouTube than anything else now. So it's really kind of changed, and just kind of staying current with the habits and kind of seeing what's in there and what makes sense. So that's kind of, it started really early, just kind of having an awareness just to keep your eyes open in terms of how people are consuming content.
And especially being on a beat like the Leafs, which is, I don't think people in the States can really comprehend how big it is. And you're
right.
One of probably dozens of reporters at every single practice and skate, if not more. Like, do you start to think about then, like, your information, what you're putting out there as a commodity? Do you start to think about differentiating? Like, when if everyone is going to be tweeting at the same time, oh, Frederik Andersen left the ice first, he's probably starting, or this guy's back on the ice in a no contact jersey. Like, do you just, okay, well, I got to put it out there, because if I don't put it out there, like, if people are just following me, they're not going to get it. Or do you start to think about, like, well, they're going to get this from the 12 other Leafs reporters they're following, if not the outlets themselves. So how can I start to, you know, give them something different or present it? Like, does that enter your mind at all, or in still to this day, does it?
It certainly starts to permeate in your mind, but I didn't think about it that way initially. It just kind of happened organically. So I'll give an example. When I joined the Hockey News in 2021, you know, I'm covering this stuff, but I'm also allowed the freedom to cover and do things the way I see fit. But because I'm independent, I'm covering my own travel, but I'm seeing the value in the travel because I can get the cost to minimal. And then I'm able to kind of help build my audience that way by showing a commitment to the beat. And you say that there's tons of people on this beat. And while that's true at home to some degree, it's getting lesser and lesser. Like, there's more and more aggregators, more and more all that other stuff out there. You know, we do some aggregation, sure. But it's got to the point where, you know, as I'm starting to put my own resources into travel, I start thinking about the business element. And to some degree, I feel I'm empowered to do so because I'm committing my own personal dollars to do it, right? It's not like I'm at some other place and some other place is taking care of all that stuff. All of this is investment in myself and the brand and the community that I'm serving. So, of course, naturally, I started to think that way. And so 2021 comes around, and I'm seeing TSN and I'm seeing Sportsnet, who are, you know, the two legacy TV stations that not only co-own the Maple Leafs, but, you know, have the main beats covered here. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I watched the TSN reporter and he would put outlines or whatever, but then he started tagging TSN Edge, which is their betting brand.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of curious about that. And they're like, yeah. Well, like, it's, you know, you learn things along the way. They're doing that to enhance the brand. So I started getting the idea. I'm like, okay, well, if that's of value, then maybe it's going to be a value to someone. And as sports betting opens up, you can start kind of seeing that value. And you know, Bodog in Canada saw the value in that. So did some other places, but you know, the deal I made was with Bodog. And so that's where it's like, look, I think it's a fair thing to do. If you're the one who's putting thousands of dollars to travel, you're a business. You're totally fair game to do that. You know, like as long as you're not doing anything that questions your allegiances and your morals. But basically, I'm not doing anything a newspaper or a legacy place does. The only difference is I have to wear six hats, where they have different people taking care of all of that. That's really the only difference. You know, I'm the salesperson, I'm the marketer, I'm the webmaster, I'm the reporter, I'm wearing multiple different hats to help grow it. Is it a lot to do? Yeah, but I'm still able to do things in a way that I'm seeing a benefit of it, and it makes sense to keep going and tell this story and tell this journey.
Let's double click into that, because I definitely want to go further and deeper and just like, let's just straight out, like, tell our audience, like, what are all the ways that you, right, frankly, that you, you know, make money for yourself and fuel these road trips. And then also, like, when you are going to work with whatever, whether it's trying to get a Bodog sponsorship or trying to get work with Tim Hortons or whatever it might be, like, what is your kind of your pitch? Like, what do they want to see from you to see that it's a good deal? So taking a step back, like, take me inside the business of David Alter and what it means to, you know, to really make this lifestyle work.
So to be honest with you, I haven't, because of the limited time constraints, it's not like I've spent a lot of time just putting out bulk pitches to different places. A lot of times it'll be places reaching out to me, and then it'll make sense one way or another where, like, that can work, or we can kind of figure out something that kind of makes sense and they see a value. And then I kind of do it that way. So one of those things was a podcast partnership for at least post-game podcast with a company out in Vancouver called Go Goat. Another one was with Bodog, and another one was with little things like the coffee thing where I give away $20 Starbucks. That's out of my own pocket. That Starbucks has nothing to do with that.
Wow.
I literally just put that out there so that there was a prize. And when I did that in 2021, that was more so a way for me to give back to fans who couldn't be at games, because I felt bad that, like, I have this privileged situation where I'm at games with an empty arena and can see it in person, even if it's not the same experience, where people at home are kind of stuck, especially in Ontario, where it was really shut down compared to any other state or province in North America for the longest time. And for me, it was just kind of a way to keep people engaged in the game, even if it was a blowout or a meaningless game. And so I thought to myself, okay, do that. And it all kind of happened organically. Now I'm starting to be a little bit more active, proactive with the sales pitch, but it's more so places going to me about certain things. I'll be like, hey, okay, that sounds good, but what if we tried this? I won't even like come at them with a pitch. Hey, can you help pay for so-and-so? It's usually just, hey, do you want to meet? Like, if someone reaches out, hey, let's meet. Maybe there's some synergies there, and then something can work out. Like, I have a partnership that doesn't pay me any money, but last summer I got a really bad injury in the gym in the summertime, and for a couple months I couldn't get the right treatment for it. Finally, my gym told me about this physio place. I saw her there, and they like fixed it. I was paying per session or whatever, and I was fine with it. They learned through talking to me what I do, and they were like, how about, you know, in exchange for free treatment, we do some sort of, they pitched it to me. So I'm like, you know what, that kind of makes sense. Like, that kind of, like, that makes sense. I'm happy to tell this journey. And they're all about physio beyond injuries as well. Like, as you get older, they call it physical therapy in the States, by the way, if you don't know what I'm talking about, but it's physio in Canada. Anyway, just things happen organically just by getting to know people and people getting to know you that they reach out. Like, part of the issue of being independent too is you don't have legacy brands where like a lot of places don't even know to reach out to you, that they'll reach out to you on Instagram or social. Like Morgan Riley had this thing with Kellogg's for like media to attend, and I didn't even know about it, but the PR person who was in charge there reached out to me 2 or 3 days prior. I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for doing that and keep me on all your lists. So like you kind of build and do things organically, but as October rolls around, and I teased it when we talked to you before we started recording, I am going to be launching a new product that will be all about this stuff from a broad standpoint, where there'll be a little bit more in terms of the trade secrets. I'm really excited for that to come out before the season starts in October.
Super, super cool stuff here. Let's keep going here. A few minutes left here. David Alton, reporter for the Toronto Maple Leafs, and truly just a entrepreneur and businessman himself. As you start to really understand the value of your platforms and the value of your audience as well, like, do you take me to where that kind of creator mindset started to fit in a little bit of like, okay, maybe I should explore TikTok as a platform, as you have. What other ways I can grow this community and engage this audience? Are you thinking about like strategically of where you should be, what kind of content's working, what's not working? There's enough hockey. Should I try some lifestyle stuff? Like, how does this kind of this mindset start to come into play for you, and how do you make decisions on where you allocate your precious time and resources, frankly?
Honestly, it comes from when you're first starting out doing this, you have little to no money. So like a lot of the motivation is, how are you going to grow? How are you going to grow this thing? And are you just content with doing whatever the job was, or are you going to try and expand your horizons a little bit? And experiences come along the way where I keep an eye on what other places and people and things and other brands are doing, and it opens my eyes. Like I'm a big wrestling fan, but more than I am about wrestling itself, I'm more of a fan of the business and marketing of wrestling than I am anywhere else. And the way they do things, I think is brilliant. Like I think just they're just so smart with how they grow the audience that way. And not even just wrestling, like the companies, but even the reporters who cover it. Like you can learn a lot from them as well in terms of how they engage with their communities that a lot of sports beats don't take advantage of. And so that's part of the newsletter creation, because like that's being able to kind of do things like that. But also like TikTok, for example, I saw it was growing in popularity, but I thought, oh, is it for me, is it not for me, I don't know. But you get to a certain age and you're like, oh, I don't know if Twitter has the same sort of magnitude as it did before. Or you just have to stay current. And so my brother, who's like 6.5 years older than me, he's got five kids. I have zero. But they range from different ages, from 6 to 18 years old. And I just decided, they didn't really know a lot about what I do. The older ones did, but the younger ones didn't. So I started flirting around with some TikToks, and then I was at a family dinner in December, and I sit down and they're like, Dave, we saw your TikToks. I'm like, okay, it's working. Because if I'm getting younger people that way and doing this kind of stuff, that means it's worth doing, because whatever I'm doing there is certainly grabbing to it. And so I'll do random stuff. Like in the off season, like a week ago, I or a week ago, a few days ago, I went to the X, which is the Canadian National Exhibition, just a fair. It's like the big fair that happens the last 2 weeks before Labor Day. And they have all kinds of foods there that are experimentations, but one of them was pickle flavored cotton candy. So on video, I'm like, okay, I'm gonna try pickle flavored cotton candy for the first
Ugh.
time and see how that works. Believe it or not, it actually tasted really good. But like even when I'm on the road, I review the media meals now and just things I see on the road that people would not normally see. And reviewing the media meals became this big thing that kind of took on its own life, because I looked at TikTok and I saw what's popular on TikTok. Okay, food, celebrity sightings, random stuff. So I started it with food, where I'm like, okay, here's the media meal. And like that thing would get like 30,000 plays. I'm like, why? Like, it's just a meal for me, but people are into that stuff. So I did that. And then about a couple months in of doing that, I was sitting down in the Leafs media room. I don't usually eat the media meals there because I'm eating at home. But I sit down there, and the guy who's head of culinary for MLSE approaches me. He's like, "Are you David?" I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "I'm a big fan of your TikToks. Like,
Wow.
I'm the head of culinary here. Like, I love watching your TikToks because it gives me a benchmark as to what
Yeah.
I can compare around the league and see what can be done. Let us know if we could do anything else. I'm gonna try to plan a thing before the season starts to try and review if they have any new menu items coming up." And
Yeah.
try to do that kind of stuff. Like, I'm trying to get more broad in that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's like I do love that stuff. But like the Leafs are a niche, and like I love doing that stuff, but I do like the broad appeal that multiple people can kind of factor in and enjoy as well. Like, even doing stories about tickets about like Leafs stuff during the playoffs, would do better on traffic because you're pulling in not just the hardcore fan, but the mainstream fans who are just kind of curious, right? Who are just kind of tuning in for the first time. They see this and they're like, "Whoa, what's this about?" So, yeah, it's just kind of just keeping your eyes open and just not being afraid to try different things and do that. And you'll get ridiculed along the way, like I have for sure. But I'm like, hey, people are into it. Like, if they're into it, I'm gonna keep doing it. And if the feet like. It's funny because like some I say what you will about TikTok and stuff, but some of the most engaging comments I see are on there. And now because I have a certain amount of followers there, I can go live, and like that's where like I think on the road you do like a check-in from the road live on TikTok and do those kind of things. So it's unique and interesting, and I don't know where things are going to go with X and some of these other new players in the industry, but you just kind of have to keep your eyes open. Someone I know who worked in marketing used to say, just find any 13-year-old kid and see what they're into, and that's usually kind of how you stay relevant in the future.
It's fascinating to think about that sort of that mindset, not necessarily a mindset shift, but like you think about what you're doing on Twitter slash X, I'm gonna call it Twitter, where like your audience is are Leafs fans. Like that's why they're following you and they
Yeah.
want to know like who's on the PP2 today, who's on the PP1 or whatever, if they're shifting out. Whereas on TikTok, you said it yourself, it's almost like the what does that what has broad appeal? Like what am I doing in my everyday life, work, job, whatever that I can capture and share with people that would find it interesting, whether they are hardcore Leafs fans or not. And so, is that kind of like your
Right.
audience outside, like on a TikTok as an example, versus versus your audience on Twitter? Do you think of that as like, okay, the audience on Twitter, like they want the hockey stuff, and yeah, they might like appreciate some of the lighthearted stuff here and there, but they want the PP too. Whereas on TikTok, like I'm looking for stuff that has that broad appeal beyond. You know, my quote unquote typical audience. Like you're a different David Alter almost on TikTok than you are on Twitter.
Yeah, I think you have to kind of separate it a little bit, right? Like, I'll put some video clips, like that thing of cotton candy. I was like, okay, I'll put it on all of them because I don't know,
Because who knows?
right? Like, but like, you're right. Like, I won't put lines on my TikTok. Like, I might just put the headline story. One thing TikTok doesn't let you do, which I wish it would, was link out like YouTube does, right? Where you could link out to a story and have your audience convert that way. They don't do that yet, but maybe they will in the future. I don't know. But yeah, the TikTok for me was like, okay, a lot of it is just understanding the platform and seeing what works. So I had TikTok. I think I had like three posts for a long time. I didn't do anything on it until December or like November of this past year. And I was like, I did a couple things, but then when I go on the platform, I just look at it and I'm looking at the kind of stuff there. I'm just seeing, okay, what do people go on this social media platform for? And so for TikTok, it's not the news. It's usually like a younger version of how to do things, hacks, little like short burst things, or like interesting things that are just kind of like, oh, hey, this is kind of interesting, right? So, for me, it was just like I'm kind of scrolling through it. I'm like, the stuff that's on TikTok seems to be very evergreen and stuff that will just kind of live for a while. like little clips, like me trying pickled cotton candy. Anyone can go to it anytime and it doesn't feel old or new. With Leaf stuff, it's a little bit different. Like people can go back to the media meal from whatever and they'll be like, oh, that's cool.
They don't need to hear you speculating about what Austin Matthews' contract is going to be anymore in a couple months from now.
Right. So like I don't know, like I won't, like that's what I found the value in TikTok, at least for me anyway. But it's going to change because like my Instagram doesn't have nearly as much as either of those two platforms, and that's the one you could argue you probably should be invested in the most from a monetization standpoint. But it's probably the one I struggle with the most. Although now it seems like Reels has replaced video, so there's more of a clear-cut direction now. So yeah, it's that's kind of I just kind of read what people kind of go to each one for. So for Twitter, it's like the hard news and linking out stories. For TikTok, it's some of the interesting video. Like people go there for dance moves and trends and that kind of stuff. Trends I might jump in on. I'm not going to be dancing on TikTok. I joked when people were like apocalypticizing the end of Twitter. I joked that I went, like, don't make me go on TikTok to dance out the line combinations. And everyone's like, you should do that anyway. And I'm like, no, I can't dance, so I'm not going to do that. You know, like I think TikTok can be like a funny experimental thing.
Like when you think about
Instagram just seems a bit more personal.
like yeah, that's true. When you think about like your own what you're putting your own time into, like it's almost another shift too of thinking about what if I was a journalist starting today, if I got laid off yesterday from like a legacy publication, like TikTok or rather Twitter, you might be able to go tell whatever The Athletic or the next Sports Illustrated or Yahoo, like look at my Twitter audience, look at how much traffic I can help generate for your website. Whereas they might not give a shit about your TikTok audience, or like maybe you could spend more all day on Twitter and try to get your audience up to tens of millions or millions or whatever, as opposed to like spreading your wealth ability. So are you thinking about like more about how can I grow my own community, my own addressable audience, because that's ultimately what I can monetize, as opposed to becoming more attractive to the next legacy outlet that may want you to help drive traffic to their site.
For me, it's about growing the community and what they care about the most. I'll give you an example. Like on my Twitter, I think today I have 42,500 followers, which, you know, as far as Leaf reporters or Leaf enthusiasts that cover the beat, it's not the highest by any means. But I would argue that my engagement rate is as high, if not higher, than most on the beat for the reason that those people are loyal to coming back to me and are repeat customers in terms of clicking on my links, in terms of getting their information firsthand from me, or whatever the case may be. So I look at that and I kind of go in that regard where I'm trying to grow things organically that way, because when you do that and you're sending people to Google to click on your story, it tells Google's algorithm, rank them higher, do whatever, and you're seeing it in all aspects of the business. And so there's some element of that to it. But then, yeah, for me, it's trying to parse out and find different things that work for different platforms for sure. So, you know, TikTok will be more about me trying funny food products I see along the way as part of the beat, or travel tips, or things that I do when I'm on the road, or places to go and kind of figure that part out, and how I capture or figure out sleep and do all these things. And for me, that's more so kind of where I think things are kind of going in this regard. So I was able to hire on a writer to help out with some of the Leafs content, who's like well known in the community, and he's been helping out a ton. And that will help me branch out to do some more of this stuff. And for me, I'm always about the higher engagement levels than I'm about the plays. So like I only have 3,200 followers on TikTok, but that grew from like a couple hundred in December. And when I see the amount of plays I have a lot of in my top videos, it's like, okay, this is a very engaged group here. The content. And also the content monetization platform is not live in Canada for TikTok yet. So we have that. We have some other challenges in Canada. There's a bill that was introduced or something that's going to remove a lot of like Canadian links on stuff, which is very
Right.
controversial, and everyone's kind of worried about it. And so we have to kind of see where that plays out. And so everything is just a constant adaptation of what the climate is. And so if something happens, you can't look at it as just a sole setback. You have to kind of figure out how do you get above this and figure that part out. And for me, that's kind of part of this journey. And that's why I'll have a newsletter about this journey, because I think I've not done something yet that feeds into that particular part of what I do.
Yeah, and the journey of being a sports writer, whether you are a Leaf supporter or not, it's just being a sports journalist.
Exactly.
And look,
Or if you're just doing you as a business.
yeah, a couple questions left here. I promise we'll get here soon. But I think
No, take all the time you need.
this is a little bit of thinking about from just a general hockey fan perspective. What have you learned when you are addressing your hockey fans, the Leafs fans? What kind of content do they want? Is it just do they want to know like the little X's and O's of what's going on with this? Now they have this formation for their power play or whatever it might be, or this they're doing this on the PK, or they're doing this with line rushes, or is it more of that lifestyle content? Is it more like which players are joking around? Like just I guess as you've started to learn about what resonates with your audience, whether it's differentiated or not, like what should we know as hockey teams trying to engage fans, as hockey leagues, as other media outlets, what have you picked up along the way and how has it maybe evolved over the years?
Yeah, so people wanting to know about the players off the ice is a big part of it as well, just kind of what they are and what they're all about, and learning more about them and how they relate, I think is a big one. But when it comes to the team and performance and stuff, there are a lot of hardcore Leaf fans who follow me who just want context and kind of look at moves on the surface that don't kind of make sense. And then what allows me in my position and my past experience, and that's where the whole math and economics and all that stuff comes into play wonderfully for me, is I'm able to take all those past experiences and people I know around the league and transpose that into explaining the why and how something happened. And
Yeah.
so that will be a lot of my articles. So for example, today I just had a thing about like why the Samsonov case went to arbitration, like why it took that long, or why is Austin Matthews' extension just this short, but he's making the most amount of money, or even last year where there were a lot of cap shenanigans and the Leafs were dressing for amateur tryout backups for the final four games of the season. I'm able to use the laws of the CBA and things I know around the league that explain why this is happening. Because on the surface of it, it looks like one big freaking joke that for four straight games, the Leafs have to dress an amateur goalie as their backup, not as a third string emergency guy, but literally as a backup. And I'm able to kind of explain because they wanted this guy there and they kind of created this situation on their own. The league said no. And I'm able to use cap rules and explain the why and the how
Yeah.
and simplify it so people don't have to go through Article 13A of the CBA and understand, well, the Leafs have to do this because of that. Like, I actually now have an intuition that I'm able to kind of anticipate roster types of things before they happen. Like when the Leafs signed Matthew Nice toward the end of the year, you know, I knew there was going to be a cap problem there, and then a goalie got hurt, and how are they going to use an exception to create a spot? And I'm able to kind of see this happen before it happens because I know under the laws of the CBA, there's only one solution to that. And so, like, even like a day before last season started, John Tavares got hurt, but it wasn't an injury that was long enough to go into injury exception. So, like, before it was even out there, my story that morning was, here's why the Leafs could start the season dressing only 19 players. And it almost happened. And then the coach confirmed, is it our understanding that if Tavares can't play, you'd have to dress a man short? He's like, yeah. And that's one where, like, I'm just knowing the CBA, that's the only option. And that's what institutional knowledge comes. And I think that's where someone like me is helpful in that regard, because people don't have to memorize that. They could just, they know from me, they're getting the why and the how of why certain things happen with this team.
You intentionally want it to be information first and then to know that it's objective, like as opposed to, I mean, I look at all these fan driven outlets now, like, I mean, the Leafs, the name I associate with Leafs, like Steve Dangle, you know, after a terrible loss, they want to hear what does Steve Dangle have to say, or you want to make sure that fans know that you're not going to inject your opinion necessarily. Oh, why are they doing this? Well, this is stupid because XYZ. You're just focusing on why this because of XYZ. It makes sense for them. This is their reasoning, at least.
I do throw my opinions every now and then. It depends on the timing and the severity of the situation or whatever the case may be, and the climate. Like, a lot of the times the people who go to you want to know your honest feelings about
Yeah,
it.
there's value in
And I
that.
think you it, yeah, there is, and you have to kind of explain it. So, like, a lot of times I've explained that the goaltending, the handling of that position within the franchise could be better. That's an opinion I've always held. Steve Dangle, I know he's a friend. I know him from, he was an intern where I at that radio station that I told you about when I was working there. I was always a big fan of his because I always felt what he was doing was aimed at the future and was only going to grow. And he's now built his own company out of that. And like, you see that in the John Boy medias, and you see a lot of that stuff that are opinion and analysis, and there's an appetite for it. You don't necessarily have to be there, but if you're giving sound, reasonable explanations and opinions that are not absurd, there's value in that. And I think reporters can do it too, to the degree. The only thing we as reporters have to be very careful of is we have relationships with these people, and we're with them and we're around them on a daily basis. So you have to be aware and sensitive to those as well. So while it may not be popular to give the middle of the road opinion, sometimes my middle of the road opinion is the opinion. But when necessary, I will go harder or lean into it. You know, your audience expects you to hold the team accountable too. If the team is playing like shit, you got to call them out on it. If they're playing well, you got to give them the kudos and you got to credit them. If you think a move is good, that's good. If you don't, then whatever. So I think there's balance in a lot of the way you handle it. And it's no different than the old journalism tenets, which are, what do they say make good columnists in journalism back in the day? Firm but fair. Just got to stick with it.
Let's piggyback off that briefly. We're just gonna keep going here all day until the start of the season, apparently. That's a good thing for me. The Leafs, as fans would know, but maybe not every listener, had turnover in their front office over the past offseason. Kyle Dubas left and went to Pittsburgh, and now you have a new regime kind of come in and having a relationship with hockey ops, having access to players, to assistant GMs, to scouts, and all that. Like that, what is that like when that regime changes? How do you start going about understanding the new kind of lay of the land, what the ropes are, who to get to know? What's that process like for you when that starts to take place?
Well, a lot of it, just because it wasn't really expected, is just kind of absorbing it, right? So that happened 5, 6 days after the end of the season. And then it's just kind of getting fallout and reaction and trying to understand why and trying to take a balanced approach as to why it happened and tries to figure out what are the things that led to that based on your experiences firsthand based on what you saw. And so in that situation, I'm able to kind of, you know, extrapolate that I noticed relationships between GM and president weren't the same as they were from when I was there back in 2014, that there were differences and things happen, and the way the economics are between MLSC and paying people to not play have changed since the pandemic. That, like, you know, maybe if this was pre-pandemic, Kyle Dubas wouldn't have been in a year in his final contract, and some sort of deal would have been made beforehand. So, like, you start to go back and figure out, how did we get here? Sorry, my dog is having fun here. But yeah, it's one of those things where you kind of have to figure that part out and then just let that breathe a bit, because it was such a sh surprise and shock. And then kind of get around the horn and figure out, okay, who's coming, who could be the next person in that regard and next in line. And so I think there's a detailed oriented process in terms of figuring that part out, and then just kind of getting to know what the new guy is all about. And that's me reaching out to the new GM and just saying, "Hey, here's who I am. I cover the team. Congrats on the position." And then I've had to text whatever for about other things, and just establishing that relationship early on that this is going to be that person and I'm going to be around, and that's essentially it, really. And going from that to kind of figuring out, okay, it's still new. I know a little bit about this guy, but let's see how it is on the daily beat when I'm on the road and I'm going to see him at every press box I'm at on the road, and like all that stuff that happens. And so that'll be a different dynamic because then we'll have, face-to-face conversations, not about hockey, about other things. Like, one of the things I like talking to Kyle Dubas about is that he was a big Detroit Lions fan. So, meaning, because he's from Sault Ste. Marie, which is on the border of Michigan and Ontario up in the northern part. So, we would talk Lions stuff all the time. And as the games were kind of getting closer and they were getting more meaningful last year, we'd share some of that stuff. And so that's pretty much the only thing we really talked about outside of work-related stuff when I'd see him on the beat and that kind of stuff. So, you get into that habit, and you kind of get to know people from a personal level. And then at that point, you can kind of say, okay, let's, just get to establish that relationship. And I think that's more important than anything else. And that's kind of what you're doing. You don't rush to judgment. You just kind of spend the time getting to know what the person's about, really.
And what's kind of your process for keeping up these relationships throughout the league? Like when a video coordinator becomes an assistant coach at this club, do you like send him a text or DM or keeping track? Do you almost have like a mini CRM of all the contacts in the league, where they're at, like what you know about them, what your last conversation was with them? Like how do you go about managing that and making sure you're cultivating those relationships to last throughout your career?
It's tough. Usually if it's someone who was around the team before and I knew from somewhere else, that's easier. Sometimes if necessary, if I know someone else is closer with them, I'll ask for an introduction that way so that person can vouch for me. And then there's that. Like at times it used to work more in the past. It doesn't so much anymore, but thanks to like a contact list that came from radio and stuff and some other places, if I had to confirm something from someone who worked somewhere else, I would just send a cold text, "Hey, here's who I am, for whatever. I was wondering if you could talk so and so, or if you could confirm this." Sometimes they'll say back, or they won't, or they won't comment, or whatever. You kind of have to go with it and do the best you can that way. But the one thing I've noticed is people respect effort, appreciation, and notice. So, you get more agents following you as you start to cover the clients of their teams, for example. And so, things like that can help in terms of setting up things like that. And it's amazing. Like, I'll give you an example. There was a fourth line player on the Leafs who would get bounced up between the minors and the Leafs last year. He ended up getting traded. But after I was done my interview with him in the Leafs press, like, I put my phone off, which I used to record. He's like, "By the way, I just wanted you to know that I go to your website to see the Leafs daily lines all the time."
That's
I'm
awesome.
like, that's so cool. Thank you for telling me that, but try and stay off social media as much as you can." Cause like I don't know. Like I thought that was really neat. You didn't have to do that. So it's cool that there's people who start to get to know you that way, right? So you're kind of aware of those relationships and figuring out stuff like that, that you're just trying to, trying to build it better that way.
That's a good place for us to end a nice lighthearted story to end on. But we're gonna have some fun with you, David, because we're not done with it yet in our sidebar segment coming up. But first episode's charitable stat coming at you right now. Awesome stuff with David Alter. Just really cool to hear his story, hear his strategy, hear how he drives engagement, drives revenue, goes in and out of the beat. what he's doing on TikTok, what he's doing on Twitter, just really interesting stuff. And we're going to have some more fun with David and learn more from him coming up in our Sidebars segment. But first, this episode's Shareable Stat. This episode's Shareable Stat comes from a recent report put together by Maverick. They're an influencer or creator marketplace company and platform software company that brands work with to work with creators. But the Shareable Stat is from a recent study that they did that was posted by eMarketer, among other places, and that is around the type of posts that brands pay for sponsored content. The top three or four are not too surprising. It's Instagram feed posts, Instagram stories, Instagram reels, and then TikTok video is the fourth one. But number five, which comprised 69%, right behind the rest of them, is Instagram Live. So brands and creators are monetizing Instagram Live content pretty effectively. Again, this is ahead of Facebook posts, ahead of any YouTube content, ahead of any stuff on Twitter or Pinterest or Snapchat or LinkedIn or podcasts. And 69% of brands or the creators in the study use Instagram Live. And that can really get you thinking. Why is live content continuing to be so powerful? Why do brands and sports make so much money on selling ads against live content? In some ways, you may look at impressions as the KPI for some of your social media posts, but impressions can be a 3-second video view, or it can be someone scrolling by really quickly when they're going through their feed. But an engagement means that they actually stopped and looked at the content, and that's why an engagement is such a powerful metric. Well, if someone is viewing something live, if they have tapped in, tuned in to your live video, it's taking up their whole screen oftentimes, and they are engaged. So really, engagement, a single engagement is pretty much the equivalent to a live viewer. And that's pretty powerful when you think about how social media posts are valued these days and what brands and advertisers are ultimately looking for someone's true attention. So how can teams, leagues, no matter where you work in, take advantage of the fact that brands are paying for creators, influencers, and potentially publishers like a sports team or sports league for this live content, for Instagram Live in particular in this case, but it could be YouTube Live, could be TikTok Live, could be live in your app potentially as well, wherever your fans are most congregating. How can you create more live content? Yes, most teams are going live these days for press conferences, after a game, sometimes before a game. How can you also create more live opportunities? It does take more trust, for sure. You may be able to do live arrivals of players, or live looks at practices or whatever it might be. But that does take trust and building up trust over time, making sure that players, that management, PR knows when you're going live. But it could also be just quick live look-ins at warm-ups. It could be live hits with your broadcasters. It could be live hits with your coach. It could be live hits with players if they're down for it. So it could be live franchises as well that you build around and then ultimately sell to a partner, of course. So how can you take advantage of more live content or create more live franchises to supplement what else you're doing on social and digital across the board and create more assets that brands want to be a part of? Because at least according to the Shareable Stat, behind only those three types of Instagram posts, stories, posts, and reels, and TikTok videos, the next one that brands are most paying for with creators are Instagram live content. So that's the social Shareable Stat. Sorry for the rambling, but more importantly, stick around because you're going to hear some good stuff from David coming up in the Sidebars segment. Right back from this episode's Shareable Stat, I'm joined once again by David Alter. He is a reporter for the Toronto Maple Leafs and just a business in and of himself, just super impressive stuff. David, are you now ready to write a few sidebars for us?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, number one. I'm going to add a bonus question to this too, but number one, the first to start with, your favorite player, past or present, to interview and why?
Oof, that's a tough one. I think right now, present is Ilya Samsonov because I come from a Russian background. My parents, it's their main language to each other. And he's like the first Russian goalie on the Leafs. And so actually being able to communicate and talk to someone in another language that you know on the beat and that he's so refreshingly honest about everything is probably my favorite right now, I'd say.
Oh, I like it. All right, the bonus part of that one is, and you can give multiple answers to this if you want to do a non-Leafs one also, is your favorite coach's scrum, or your favorite coach to have an interview with. I know I spent many years myself watching Randy Carlyle look up at the ceiling, so I'm sure you had those experiences as well. But tell me that coach's scrum that was the best, whether, again, Leafs or non-Leafs.
I would say Paul Maurice would probably be the best.
Okay.
Like, he just seems to give really good anecdotal stuff, and just he kind of knows what you need when you're kind of talking to him. Like, and he doesn't belittle any question. I think he creates the most welcoming of any type of question environment of any coach I've ever asked a question to or thought of. And I think that helps because he was at one time a Leafs coach. Now, I wasn't on the Leaf beat when he was coach of the Leafs back then, but I was around. He'd coached the Marlies before that too. But I got to see how he conducted himself firsthand when the Leafs were taking on the Panthers in that playoff round. I was just incredibly impressed.
Yeah,
So
no,
I think for me, Paul Maurice.
that's a good one, and I'm kind of not surprised either. He seems like you come off as a smart, intelligent, and well-rounded guy. Number two for you,
Yeah.
David. Tell me, the writer or reporter that you most enjoy reading and why.
Ooh, that's an interesting one. Reporter, writer that I most enjoy reading could be any sport right now.
Sure, any sport.
Okay, so for enjoy reading, I would for hockey, I think it'd be a tie between Chris Johnstone and Elliot Friedman, especially because there's context that relays a lot to the Leafs. I admire both of them a lot. And I really enjoy the context that they're able to provide. Non-Leafs, and it's not really sports, but a reporter I kind of admire, he's kind of new to the beat in that regard, is I don't know if you've heard of Sean Ross Sapp, but he's kind of a emerging go-to voice when it comes to wrestling news and just the business model that he's created for himself. He just gives you the straight goods of what's going on. That I found that to be very entertaining in terms of learning about the business element of it. There's a few other sports business people I do like following. Can't remember names, but a couple of the like I'm a big sports business guy, so like I like Sportico, SBJ as well. I do read. I do like a lot of some of the front office sports stuff as well. I like their approach to newsletters. And so I'm a big fan of those as well.
Like it. Lots of good stuff there to clean. Number three for you, David. Tell me, if you talk to a Western University student tomorrow who's like, I want to be a sports writer or a sports reporter, when I graduate, what advice would you give to them?
Build an audience any way you can. Find something you love, stick to it, and focus on growing it. And consistency is key. Don't just do it if you don't feel like you can't make a multi-year commitment to it, because a lot of audience growth just doesn't happen overnight. It takes a lot of passion and dedication to it. There's a popular, so I'm a big tech nerd as well, and I didn't really get into that in the first part of the podcast, so I follow a lot of tech journalists. And it was actually something I thought I was going to do if sports journalism didn't work out, because I've always loved gadgets and stuff. Anyway, so there's a very popular YouTube channel called Unbox Therapy that's started by this guy Lewis, based out of Toronto. And he started his channel as he worked at a computer store in Spadina in college, which is downtown, just kind of teaching people stuff there. And he was doing stuff, it was whatever, but then it took one video to go viral, and then he became a sensation. And he was the first one to do the iPhone 6 bend gate, where
Yeah.
he took an iPhone, showed the metal behind it, and was able to bend it just like that. And that thing took off like crazy. And then he's been able to make that a business just straight out of that. Sometimes, and that may not have happened, but because he had been doing it for years and built up an audience to do it, that's how we did it. If you're starting out and you don't have that, try and find some internship work or stuff with a legacy place so that you could at least have somewhere to start with your audience, but then evaluate yourself every 6 months to see where you can go and push it even further so that you can grow beyond the outlet you're working for.
No, it's really good advice. It's really cool to think that, I mean, hell, when you and I were coming up, we didn't really have this option quite as much of
No.
you can graduate with a built-in audience already. It's waiting to hear from you. And like, you can, there's nothing stopping you from starting now, starting today, to build up that
Right.
YouTube or Twitter or TikTok or Instagram, whatever it might be. It's a pretty inspiring thing to think about.
Yeah, for sure. So it's just doing that stuff and figuring out, like, find the platform where you can get it, but then start trying to focus on building you and finding your edge and your passion. And those two things combined will get you to where you want to go.
Number four, David, I'm psyched to hear this one. Tell me the most memorable story that you've ever written or reported on. If you're a, you know, when you're old and gray, 50 years from now, and you're thinking back, what's that story you're gonna be like? That was pretty cool. Well, that was pretty good.
I think it's, there's a couple, but one that stands out to me is when I was at the Athletic. There was this pressure where we're the new place on the beat, and in addition to just writing for you're writing for the platform to get attention. And so there was a player on the Maple Leafs who's now in the media because he's since retired, who just was two for 2 months. He was just an eighth defenseman on the team. His contract status was such that they couldn't send him down because he'd get claimed. And the coach wasn't playing him. So he was just kind of sitting there for 2 months. So I kind of went up to him and after everything and just did an interview with him. And he poured it. First off, I was appreciative to him for telling me everything honestly and candidly. And I went with it. And the thing took off like crazy to the point where the legacy outlets had no choice but to say me of the Athletic in the story because it became the number one story in the market. So for me, that was pretty cool because I felt I did my job in addition to telling the crucial story, but also helping a startup brand. Yes, Shelby. Sorry, my dog is just a green in that way. But just being able to tell the just be able to get the word out about the brand, which is subscription based. And so for me, that was a real big thing.
That's really cool. I'll check that out. Number five for you, David. This is what direction you'll take it in, but we've seen the explosion of generative AI, ChatGPT, Midjourney, Stable Diffusion. Maybe we're going to get video generative AI in the near future. What's kind of your take on, and how are you paying attention to it? Do you see it as happening for you yet, whether for image creation or for, helping you go with your transcripts? Like, is there any place for generative AI in your own journalism yet, or in the future?
Yeah, so what I've only used AI for one thing in journalism, and it's purely subjective, suggestive, I should say. And what it is for me, it's me, like now that I write for myself, I have to think about headlines. And so what I'll do is I'll take my suggested headline and I'll be like, okay, what's a better SEO optimized headline for this? Because I was never good at headlines. And so I'll look at some free suggestions and I might go with them if they are better, but a lot of times they aren't. And so I'll look at it from a, hey, you know what? That actually sells it more than than my idea. And if it's optimized for SEO, that means it's actually going to perform better in Google than the headline that I came up with. And so, as long as it's not misleading or outrageous, I think there are places for it. But yeah, there is that concern. I've never let it do copy for me ever. I've never let it really fact check because a lot of times it's wrong. I am curious from a planner standpoint, if it would make sense for someone like me in terms of how to plan out my day, letting AI do like task management. From that standpoint, it makes a lot of sense, but I'll never let it pick things for me. I'll maybe let it come up with suggestions, but in the end, I'll be making the final decision because you still need a human to discern everything.
Totally. No, I think it's the right way to go about it. It's that co-pilot. It's someone to bounce ideas off of, get some other opinions, and then you
Yes.
are the final arbiter.
It's a co-pilot is a great way to actually put it. Just like how, pilots fly the plane, even though the controls and flight traffic can do everything, you still need a person there. Like it's kind of like I drive a Tesla and I have autopilot and all, on long road trips, I definitely turn on the autopilot, but I keep my eyes forward and I'm ready to take over whenever.
Number six for you, David. Don't worry, Shelby. We're almost done.
I think I lost David.
Get to the bottom here. Tell me the most memorable game that you've been at for work or as a fan. Whether for work or as a fan, what's the most memorable game?
I have a few because I've been to a lot of things. Because prior to 2011, when I wasn't the Leafs reporter, I was General Simon. So I've done absolutely every sport. I've been to two Olympics. So I went to Vancouver in 2010 and London in 2012. 2012 was especially cool because the radio rights holding team that I went from, it was 14 people for Vancouver and it was only two of us for London. And so that meant I got to do a lot of crazy assignments. Like I got to be in the main stadium Canada radio spot for a lot of big events that happened at Olympic Stadium in London. And so like I got to see the 100 meter final like up close and personal. Wow. Like there where you got to witness, I've never felt silence before in my life, where like you're in a stadium of 80,000 for a big event and you go from hearing ambient noise around to everyone completely silent before that gun goes off. Yeah. That you could actually feel that silence. So that was pretty cool. I've done a couple Olympics there. In 2015, I was freelancing for CP while I was in between a couple of hockey jobs, and I got to go to I got to string for AP Radio for the Jays playoff series against Texas in 2015. So I got to be there in person for the Joey Bats bat flip moment. So that was pretty electric and cool to witness. There's been a lot. For The Athletic, my first day on the job. So The Athletic launched in Toronto, October 13th, 2016. The first thing I ever did for them really was October 12th, 2016, which was go to Ottawa and witness Austin Matthews' first game. And that was the 4-goal debut. Yeah. And that was pretty insane to witness because I had a lot of first party account of what that experience was like. And people really wanted that experience. So there's a lot of them. Like I've been very blessed. I have a shoebox of every credential I've had collected to anything since 2006. It's actually now I'm on my third big box of that stuff because the credentials pile up. Even if they're single day nothing, it's in there. So I have a couple of Olympics in there. I've never been to a Super Bowl. I would have loved to have gone to a Super Bowl, but that hasn't happened for me yet.
If you ever have too many of those press credentials, I know NFL commentator and reporter and community leader himself, Ross Tucker, oftentimes will do little giveaways of those to his Twitter audience or his Instagram audience. So there's maybe an opportunity there for you.
So that does sound like a good idea on the face of it, but like there's disclaimers on the back that you shouldn't do that. So like I've always like it might be a cool memento and it says the date or whatever, but even if it says the date, if someone just, you know how security is. Sometimes you splash it, they'll think you're supposed to be there and it can create all kinds of stuff. Like we're explicitly told don't share those. So like I don't personally.
Good point there. All right, number seven for you, David. Oh, this is gonna be an interesting one. Tell me, this is a two-parter here. First, if you were commissioner of NHL for a day, what is one change you would make? And then second, if you were head of Twitter for a day, what is one change you would make? So head of NHL.
Head of NHL. The big change I would make is from a marketing standpoint and start changing the focus on the players in addition, like more of a focus on the players and marketing around the players than about the teams. As important as the teams are, I feel the NHL really lags in that department. I was actually doing a podcast with someone before where we were talking about just how important like what the NBA does and how the NHL can kind of learn from it. Like mid-season tournaments, I love that idea. Like I like a lot of different things that can grow the game, but they just need to do more social media-wise that focus on the individual players because that brings more league-wide awareness than just generic team stuff. And I don't think the NHL understands that enough. As far as Twitter goes, that's a tough one because I actually used to work at Twitter. But I don't know what Twitter can do more than it is right now in terms of just what they do, but maybe more of a change in terms of educating and the partnerships and maybe more of a more moderation, I guess, let's put it that way. When I was there, I was a human moderator for stuff that would go in the moment in the
Yeah.
news stuff, and I liked that part of Twitter, and so I probably would do a little bit more in terms of moderation. Like I do think content creation and building business is important, and they're doing some stuff there, but you wonder at what cost. So that would probably be the change I would make there.
Yeah, good call. Number eight for you, David. This is one I'm always excited about our food questions, and we got someone here who has lots of experience with press box deals and being parts of different cities as well. So tell me, the NHL rink with the best press box. Oh, so it's a two-parter here: the best press box in general for any reason, and then secondarily, the best press meal.
Okay, the best press meal is Detroit, Michigan, hands down. I'm actually bummed that the
Ooh.
Leafs are not going to be there during the regular season this year because their one game on the road in Detroit is actually designated for the games in Europe. But that's fine because I'll go to Europe instead. But that there's that element. But Detroit is the best. Little Caesars Arena, they have this big buffet for all Red Wings and Pistons games, and it's majestic. It's so great. They have like so many different proteins, so many different things that you just, it's a scene, man. That's by far the best. The best press box experience is Montreal. Montreal, it like you feel the vibe of the crowd behind you because it hangs, but you can feel the energy of the Canadiens fans behind you. I might be a bit biased because every time I'm in Montreal, it's Leafs Habs games, which is the Mecca. A Leafs Habs game in Montreal is by far the best experience of any hockey experience. So that's the best press box. It hangs in a really good spot. You feel the energy of the crowd, and you feel like you're at an event. So, Detroit best press meal, Montreal best press box.
No arguments there. That's some great responses. Number nine, David, last one here, but maybe the hardest question, and this is going to force you to reckon with whether the Leafs are ever going to win a cup or not. Who will end up winning more Stanley Cups, Austin Matthews or Connor McDavid?
I have no idea.
It could be a tie at zero. I hope for
I'm
Canada.
gonna say I'm gonna say Austin Matthews, and I'm only gonna say that because I think Austin Matthews has more of the contract flexibility to pick and choose where he wants to go, where that can kind of make sense. There hasn't been a Canadian team winning the Cup since '93.
I
And
know.
that's what makes that question so hard to answer. But it's a fluky stat when you factor in that there's been, I think it's seven Canadian teams that have gone to a cup final. And I think it's five that went all the way to game seven. So it's really a fluke, like when you think about it. But yeah, I'm going to say Austin Matthews just because I think the circumstances will change for it. I could be dead wrong on that. That is, it's a very impossible answer to kind of figure out because it all I think circumstances, teammates, teams are going to change that. Connor McDavid might be able to do more on his back in terms of pushing that. He's definitely won more playoff series in that regard, but I don't know. It's very tough. It's very tough to answer that question. It could be the same. It could be Austin Matthews getting more. It could be with the Leafs. It may not be with the Leafs. He's only a Leaf until age 31 for now. So we'll see.
Should be interesting to watch. I know the whole entire country of most of the entire country of Canada, which is just waiting for any Canadian team to win the cup, let alone the marquee franchise with the Leafs. And you'll be there to document it one way or another.
Yes, yes, I will.
Picked ass in your sidebars. Now your chance to take over the podcast for me and tell us your social media all-star to follow. Just tell us who they are, what platform or platforms that they're on, and why they're following.
Who I like to follow on
Yeah,
social media?
who you recommend, someone that you recommend all our listeners check out and follow.
If you're a hockey fan, definitely like Elliot Friedman. I think he's become like the go-to insider. I think that's for at FriedHNIC, in terms of that. I think that's really important. I like a lot of the sports business stuff I think that's really important as well. Like the front office sports, the Sporticos, I think are really worth following. The Action Network as well, even though they do betting, I think they do a lot of the business element as well. I think those are some really key follows. Outside of that, just lean into what you're passionate about, what makes sense. There's some tech stuff that I like as well, The Verge. I think that's really good if you kind of want to get a sense of what's happening in the tech world that might be able to help you. The Verge and CNET are really good follows as well.
Good shout out there for sure. How about you, David? Where can we find all the places where you are and your work across digital social?
Yeah, I'm at Dalter on Twitter, and I'm at David Alter 35 on all the other ones. It's unfortunately when you have a common name, you can't necessarily have all the handles that way. David Alter 35, 35 was my lucky number. I was born on the 3rd of May, and it was my goalie number. It made sense in a lot of ways. So that's kind of how I figured that part out. But at David Alter 35 is where you can find my non-Twitter stuff. Dalter is where you can find me on Twitter covering Leafs.
Check him out. He's got more good stuff on the way, as he alluded to, coming out in the next month here, depending on when you're listening. Just so impressive what you've done, whether you're a Leafs fan, a fan of just how to make it in this journalism space, or what the lifestyle is like of a journalist. There's so much to follow along with, David, and cannot thank you enough for coming on the podcast today, man.
I appreciate it. Thank you again for having me on, Neil.
Thanks so much again to David Alter. Really interesting talking to him, learning from him, following along with his journey, what he's doing across social to earn fans, earn engagement, earn revenue opportunities, create his own revenue opportunities. Just really awesome stuff, and look forward to continuing to follow along with David Alter, with his newsletter coming out, with everything that he's going to be doing as the NHL season kicks off, not too far away from here, depending on when you're listening to this podcast. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Thanks again for listening. As always, I'm your host, Neil Horwitz. Hit me up on Twitter, NJH287. Also, connect with me on LinkedIn or see more content there. The website with everything is dsmsports.net. And check out the podcast. Follow, subscribe so you don't miss an episode on whichever podcast platform is your favorite. Until next time, this is Neil Horwitz signing off for the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast.